True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
It was literally as if we weren't even on the road.
Yeah.
She's coming toward us. You know, I mean, I'm blinking my lights and beeping the horn, and she's flailing. And we drove up on the grass because otherwise we would have been hit. She never put on a brake. She never even, her eyes didn't even move.
It was just, I'm going where I want to go. I'm doing what I need to do. Right. I'm where I want to be.
And then she went around the bend onto the highway itself.
We know that Diane Schuler enters the Taconic State Parkway going south in the northbound lane, approximately 1.7 miles north of the point of impact. She drives this 1.7 miles at a high rate of speed, and you have half a dozen callers to 911.
State Police, 911.
State Police, you got a northbound Taconic. There's a minivan in the right lane going southbound.
911.
Hi, I'm at the Taconic Expressway. We just passed the 100 exit 100 feet. There's a car going like 70 miles an hour the wrong direction.
It was very surreal seeing it coming at you. So what you had to do was, you know, thank God there was nobody on the side. I was able to go over a couple of lanes as the van came by me. And I said at the time 70 miles an hour because it was speeding right by. Dead pin straight, that like pin straight. Wasn't doing this, was dead pin straight. Right after it happened, that's when I called 911.
State Police 911.
Yeah, you got a guy driving south on a northbound Taconic Parkway. Ooh, my God, I was in the left lane. Just past Pleasantville Road. He's going like a bat out of hell. He should be already on the same parkway right now. It's a minivan.
State Police 911, where's your emergency?
Hi, I'm on the constant. Hang on the storm now.
The van that's going southbound?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're going out for it.
My heart was going about 200, you know, beats a minute. And, you know, just to react quickly, get out of the way, and then the car went past us.
It's like playing chicken. I mean, she was going straight on the road. We saw something coming at us. We reacted, we moved. She had no reaction at all. She didn't stop, she didn't slow down, she didn't move.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick. This holiday season, give the gift of safety with Saber, the number one brand of pepper spray used by police and consumers worldwide. Saber offers maximum strength pepper spray and gel, as well as some other great devices to keep everyone safe this season and throughout the year. Their attention-grabbing personal alarms are audible up to 1,000 feet away, which is truly exceptional. They also have easy-to-install home security options. Great for those of us who aren't very handy around the house, but still watch a lot of true crime shows. Go to saberred.com/truecrimebrewery and use code TRUECRIME to get 20% off your order. That's SABRED.com/truecrimebrewery.
Let me tell our listeners about a great find of mine, MyFit Jeans. These jeans are made from the softest fabric called FlexTech Denim, and they're designed to fit all women. I'm not kidding. Whether you're at your fittest or you're having a bloated day, MyFit jeans conform to your curves and they just feel great. I also love their wide waistband too, which prevents any chance of a muffin top. You are going to love MyFit jeans, and right now they're offering our listeners an exclusive deal. Buy one pair and get 15% off. If you buy two pair, you get 50% off the second pair as well. Just go to MyFitJeans.com and enter code BREWERY for 15% off your first pair and 50% off your second pair. That's MyFitJeans.com and promo code BREWERY. Then let me know what you think, because I think they're pretty amazing. Today, we're tackling the fascinating and tragic case of the Taconic Parkway crash. It was a sunny July day in 2009, and 36-year-old Diane Schuler was driving southbound in the northbound lanes of the Taconic State Parkway from the Pleasantville Road exit in New York. Witnesses watched in horror as a minivan barreled down the parkway in the wrong direction. Blaring horns, flashing lights, and cars swerving out of their way seemed to make no difference. She appeared to be focused and deliberate as she continued to travel at a high rate of speed toward oncoming traffic. When the minivan collided head-on with an oncoming car, it held 5 children. Diane, 4 children, and the 3 passengers in the other car were killed. The investigation that followed revealed that Diane was intoxicated. Toxicology tests revealed that she had recently ingested both alcohol and marijuana. Her husband, Daniel, defended his wife, denying that she drank heavily or used any drugs. Daniel believes that there must have been a medical reason for Diane's behavior. Some believe it was an accident caused by her alcohol and drug use. Others believe it was a murder-suicide. Today we're going to take a look at the day of the crash and the events in Diane's life leading up to that day. Diane's life as a responsible professional and an attentive mother didn't seem to mesh with her being an alcoholic with a death wish. So what happened that day? Join us at the quiet end for an in-depth examination of the facts in this tragedy. But first, beer. And I feel a little bad about the beer, as this is a drunk driving case.
I know. I was thinking of maybe not doing one.
You're doing an alcohol-free beer.
Yeah, or then the other part of it is it's such a horrific crime that occurred.
Yes.
That maybe I want a really strong beer.
That's true.
Get things out of my mind.
Yeah, just as long as we're clear to people that we would never drink and drive.
No.
We enjoy our beer. We take an Uber home.
We do.
Yep.
But anyway, today's beer is called After Image, brewed by Grim Artisanal Ales in Brooklyn. Nice New York beer. It's a New England IPA. Everybody loves IPAs these days, and everybody really loves New England IPAs. So these are pretty fruity beers, and I guess that appeals to people. I'm not a particularly big fan of New England IPAs. So this one, After Image, is an opaque light yellow color with a small white head, little tiny bit of lace, a lot of fruit in the aroma, and then you can get a hint of pine. Then when you taste it, you've got some mango, some tangerine, kind of some orange rind in there, a little bitterness, and then the pine comes on late.
Sounds like an IPA.
It is.
Yeah.
It's just a fruitier IPA, but it's overall a pretty nice beer.
Okay.
And Grim brews some great beers, so.
Yeah, we've had others by them, and they do make a good beer. So let's open it up and head down to the quiet end.
So Diane Schuler grew up as Diane Hance in a large Catholic household in Floral Park, which is a comfortable New York suburb. She is the 4th child of Warren Hance Sr. and Eileen Hance. She had 3 brothers. Now, when Diane was just 9 years old, her mother Eileen left the family, and Diane was estranged from her mother until she died.
Yeah, and I think her mother actually left the family for another man, so that made it even kind of worse.
Yeah, I think that's what people were dancing around in the stuff we've read or watched.
There was an extramarital affair.
She ran off with a neighbor, actually.
Right. So that's traumatic, especially for a little girl losing her mom.
That's tough. And then the other thing, her brothers eventually were on good terms with her. Diane never was able to have any relationship with her mother.
Well, she didn't want to.
Right.
Right? Yeah.
And her mother tried.
Yes.
So statistically, this would put her at risk for depression, anxiety, and drug dependence. But Diane didn't show any signs of difficulty. She is actually a very hard worker who got good grades and excelled in soccer in high school.
Yeah, so even so it didn't show, I'm sure it did affect her.
Well, you're 9 years old, growing up, and your mom's gone?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course it affected her.
Mm-hmm.
So Diane attended Nassau Community College on and off in the 1990s, and she married Daniel Schuler, who she had met at a wedding. Diane's friends from back then have said that Diane hadn't really dated before Daniel, so he was her first love. As Diane made her mark in corporate accounting at Cablevision, Daniel became a public safety officer for the Nassau County Police Department. These officers are not armed, but they do patrol county facilities.
So it's like a security guard.
Basically, right?
Yes.
So Diane was the primary breadwinner. And I think at the time of the crash, she was making about $100,000 a year.
6 figures, I'm not sure exactly, but it was over $100,000.
Yeah.
So the couple bought their first house in West Babylon in 2003, and neighbors said they were a pleasant couple. They described Diane as attentive to the children. She was a big planner, and she was the decision maker in the family. Diane was a woman who seemed to really have it all together, though. Daniel generally worked the 4 p.m. to midnight shift, so during the week he didn't see a lot of Diane because she's in the corporate world, she's working days. Neighbors said they didn't see the couple argue or witness anything indicating an alcohol problem. There were no reports of domestic incidents at the house, and Diane had a clean driving record, even though Daniel had had a previous DUI. So Diane would crash 4 hours after leaving an upstate campground in Sullivan County, New York. A caller to the local news channel, WABC Channel 7, said the campground at Hunter's Lake, where she and her family regularly stayed, is known as a boozing area where wild parties are the norm. The news also heard from a viewer who had spent the past 10 years as a seasonal camper at Hunter Lake, and he claimed that he noticed a lot of drinking among the campers there, although he didn't specifically say that about the Shulers. So it might be unfair to put too much weight on that.
Right. And the owner of the campground vehemently denies that it's a big drinking camp. She said that people drink responsibly, and if they drink alcohol and move around from campsite to campsite, she's going to kick them out.
Well, yes, but you have to take that with a grain of salt, because she has a dog in the fight.
I know. This is after the fact.
Right. So Diane's neighbors and friends describe Diane as a very high achiever and a bit of a perfectionist. Those close to Diane claimed that she was the perfect image of a doting mom and aunt, a hardworking executive with a six-figure salary, and they said she was close to a teetotaler, someone who might sip on half of an alcoholic beverage like a daiquiri or a pina colada on just a rare occasion. But looking back, it appears that she must have been using alcohol and marijuana to cope with her life. We don't think that the first time she took a drink was on the day of the crash. That just wouldn't make sense.
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
Yeah. So let's go over the timeline on the day of the crash.
Okay. So on the weekend of July 25th, 26th, when Diane Shuler and her husband Daniel were at a lakefront campground in Sullivan County with their children and three nieces, everything seemed normal. Fellow campers who have known the family for years saw no signs of conflict. That Sunday, the 26th, between 5 in the morning and 6 in the morning, Daniel said he woke up and cleaned the boat and was getting ready to head home. Diane woke up a little bit later. She was the one who packed up their things and got the kids ready to leave. At 9:30 in the morning, Diane left the Hunter Lake campground in her brother Warren's 2003 maroon Ford Windstar. Riding with Diane were her 5-year-old son, Brian, and 2-year-old daughter, Erin, and her brother's 3 daughters, Emma, who was 8, Allison, 7, and Kate, 5. Husband Daniel left the campground at the same time in a separate vehicle since he had a pickup truck, and he took the dog with him. Co-owner of the campground later said that Diane appeared sober when she drove away and the children all seemed happy.
On the way to West Babylon, Diane stopped at a McDonald's fast food restaurant. At 9:56, Diane and the kids stop at the McDonald's and get breakfast for everyone. And she has a long conversation with several employees. She didn't appear intoxicated to anyone who spoke to her in person or to the police when they watched the surveillance tape. Witnesses said that she didn't smell of alcohol. The children played on the little playground there, and they ate McDonald's food, and Diane appeared completely normal. At 10:33 a.m., Diane did purchase an orange juice and took it to the car with her, and then they left the McDonald's. It was only 3 minutes later at 10:36 when Diane stopped at a Sunoco gas station and briefly looked around inside for pain meds and then asked the clerk for them. She didn't appear intoxicated to the employee or on the surveillance tape. She doesn't, on camera, appear to be drinking or smoking anything during the stop. While at the gas station on surveillance video, which has no sound, it was reported that she attempted to buy some over-the-counter pain relief medication. Maybe for a painful tooth, maybe for a headache, but the gas station didn't sell the Tylenol gel cap she wanted, so she didn't buy any Tylenol or anything for pain, which is curious to me.
Well, it is to me, too. I mean, if you prefer the gel cap, fine, but at this point, she's like an hour or so away from home, and she could have purchased some regular Tylenol or something like that and then gone home and had her gel cap.
Yeah, we're going to talk more about that because that to me is an interesting tidbit.
It is, definitely. Diane left Liberty at about 11 a.m., traveling along Route 17, Interstate 86, and the New York Thruway, which is Interstate 87, entering the Ramapo service area and crossing the Tappan Zee Bridge, heading east. Several witnesses later reported seeing a red minivan driving aggressively on Route 17, Interstate 86, and Interstate 87, including aggressively tailgating, flashing headlights, honking the horn, moving in and out of lanes, and straddling two lanes. So we've got an hour and a half since they left, and there's signs of something going on.
Yeah, right. Yep. So it was at 11:37 when Diane spoke to Warren Hance. That's her brother and the father of her three nieces who were in the car. So she spoke to him on her cell phone. I believe it was his oldest daughter who made the call. And she reportedly told him that they were being delayed by traffic. According to a police report, Diane was seen by witnesses at about 11:45, so just a few minutes later, by the side of the road with her hands on her knees as if she was vomiting. And she was seen again in the same position a short time later at a rest stop. So between 11:30 and noon, witnesses reported seeing the minivan driving erratically and aggressively on Route 17. At 12:08, Jackie Hance, Warren's wife and the mother of the three nieces who were in Diane's car, called Diane and talked to her for less than 2 minutes and said that this was a normal conversation. At 12:13, just 5 minutes later, the van passed through the Harriman Toll Plaza. Between 12:15 and 12:45, there were witnesses that reported that a minivan, driven by a woman matching Diane's description, was weaving aggressively in and out of the traffic. They report that she was straddling lanes, honking her horn, and tailgating quite aggressively. Also within this time frame, witnesses said that a red minivan was pulled over on the side of the road, and a woman matching Diane's description was seen sitting on the guardrail and appeared sick. One witness would say that the minivan began tailgating him and attempted unsuccessfully to pass him on the road's shoulder. And then she honked the horn repeatedly at this driver for about a mile. So this is very strange, aggressive behavior.
Sure is. And this is the same witness who pulled into the Sloatsburg rest stop and went to the McDonald's there. Now, the minivan followed him, but headed toward the truck parking area before driving back over the grassy area and into the car parking area. So it sounds like she went one way and then hopped a curb.
Yeah.
Crossed the grass.
Yeah.
The witness reported that the female driver of the minivan appeared to be ill.
Yeah, and when he came out again, the van was gone.
Yeah.
So at 12:55, there was a wrong number dialed from Diane's phone, and we don't know if it was Diane or one of the kids trying to make a call. Could have very well been the kids trying to get help. Although, I would think the 8-year-old who already called her dad would know how to call him back and not get a wrong number. Unless they're fighting over the phone, who knows?
Maybe, although maybe they're all panicked.
Oh, sure.
Because of what's going on.
I'm sure they were, and that's a really horrific part about it, is just to think what these children were going through. So scary.
Yes, it is. So at 12:58, 3 minutes after the wrong number from Diane's phone, 8-year-old Emma called her father again, and this time she was upset and in a panic. She told her dad that her Aunt Diane was incoherent, having trouble seeing, was confused and lost. Emma said there's something wrong with Aunt Diane. And her mother Jackie heard the children crying in the background. Then the call was dropped.
So that's terrifying.
1 minute after 1 p.m., Warren called Diane back, and they spoke for about 8 minutes. At this time, the minivan passed through the Tappan Zee Toll Plaza. Warren would later describe Diane as disoriented at this point. She slurred her words and called him Danny. That's her husband.
Yeah.
Emma got on the phone and Diane pulled over. Emma told her dad that she saw a sign that read Sleepy Hollow and Tarrytown. Diane took the phone again and Warren told her to wait there for him.
So at 1:10, four more wrong numbers were called from Diane's phone, and then Diane left her phone on the concrete barrier where she'd pulled off, and then she drove off again. At 1:15, Warren called Diane's phone back and got her voicemail, and over the next 20 minutes or so, almost a dozen other calls to her phone went right to voicemail. So he and his wife Jackie, whose three kids are in the car, contacted police. And what they thought at the time is that Diane was having some kind of a medical emergency, and they were trying to get help for their daughters. But Diane was absolutely someone they trusted, so they never considered that she had been drinking. That wasn't even on their radar. But they gave police a description, but police couldn't find the van in time to help because Diane had actually gone in one direction and then turned around before heading the wrong way on the Taconic Parkway.
So investigators were trying to determine how and why Diane got from the bridge, the Tappan Zee, to the Taconic State Parkway ramps near Briarcliff Manor, which is from where the next information in this timeline comes. So she's kind of incognito for a while, traveling different directions, and she ends up on the exit ramp. At 1:33, two drivers called 911 after noticing the van moving onto the northbound exit ramp in the wrong direction onto the Taconic State Parkway near Briarcliff Manor. The end of the exit ramp at the intersection with Pleasantville Road is marked with two signs that read "Do Not Enter" and two signs that read "One Way." Within the next minute, four more 911 calls were placed by drivers who reported that a car was traveling the wrong way down the parkway, going about 75 to 85 miles per hour.
So the van traveled south for 1.7 miles in the parkway's northbound passing lane before it collided head-on at about 1:35 p.m. with a 2004 Chevy Trailblazer. And then the Trailblazer struck a 2002 Chevy Tracker. At the time of impact, Diane was traveling about 85 miles an hour. So Diane, her daughter, and two of her nieces were dead at the scene of the crash. The children didn't appear to have been in car seats or to even have seat belts fastened, according to some witnesses. There were three men in the Trailblazer, 81-year-old Michael Bastardi, his 49-year-old son Guy, and their friend, 74-year-old Dan Longo. And the two occupants of the Tracker only suffered minor injuries.
Now, Diane's severely injured third niece and her 5-year-old son, Brian, were taken to area hospitals. The niece died later that day. Diane's daughter and her other two nieces were deceased at the scene.
Yeah, so Brian's the only passenger of the minivan to survive, and he had bone fractures and severe head trauma. He was actually awake when rescuers removed him from the van. His eyes were closed, but he was crying and he was moving around. So two men who witnessed the accident and saw smoke rising out of the van ran to help. And after removing Diane, who kind of fell out of the van on top of them or towards them, they saw a large broken Absolut vodka bottle by the driver's side. They tried to pull the girls out of the van, and one man said that because the children weren't seatbelted and they were all thrown together, they didn't even notice Brian at first, who was stuck under another child. Now, other witnesses would say that the children were buckled in, so there are conflicting stories about that. But most witnesses agree that the kids did have their seatbelts on. And maybe the thing that saved Brian is that he was underneath some of the other kids. But, so, I mean, needless to say, it was a horror scene.
Yeah. I mean, we saw clips of that.
Horrible.
It's just unreal.
Yeah, it really was. So let's take a short break here for our advertisers.
All right.
Because I'd like to put in a good word here for Madison Reed, a company founded by a woman who's on a mission to revolutionize the way that we women color our hair. With the holidays approaching, we are all strapped for time, but we do all want to look our best. I'd been getting my hair colored at the salon, and I honestly never thought I would color my hair at home again, but that was before Madison Reed entered my life. For decades, we've had two options: outdated home hair color or the time and expense of salon coloring. But with Madison Reed, you'll look like you went to the salon, but you'll have me time to do the things you love. Like for me, this time of year, it's wrapping gifts as I listen to my favorite true crime podcasts. Join me in getting multidimensional European hair color delivered to your home on your schedule for under $25. Canceling that salon appointment can be very empowering. You can find your perfect shade at madison-reed.com. Madison Reed is honoring our True Crime Brewery listeners with 10% off and free shipping on your first color kit with the promo code BREWERY. That's madison-reed.com and use the promo code BREWERY to get 10% off and free shipping. The code again is BREWERY.
And support for today's show also comes from Hopsy, my new fave. Why fight the lines at the mall when you can give the gift of fresh beer from the tap with Hopsy? So Hopsy's like the Nespresso or Keurig for beer. That's how I look at it. Brings beer on tap to the comfort of your own home with the Sub, which is a countertop appliance that fits neatly in your kitchen, bar, or living room. And with a rotating variety of beer styles like IPAs, stouts, and pilsners from both big and small breweries, you'll be sure to find something you love. We just got our little kit. I got the Sub and a couple mini kegs.
You were so excited, like a little boy on Christmas morning.
So, and we had some guests over on Black Friday, and I wanted to show off my new apparatus. So the Sub is a pretty sleek-looking thing. It looks great in the kitchen on the counter.
Yeah, it's not overwhelming at all. It's okay. It looks nice.
The mini kegs were easy to insert. Pouring was a cinch without any spilling. I had an IPA and a brown ale. People enjoyed them. I mean, who doesn't like a good draft beer? So this is a no-brainer for me. Great beer on tap, reasonably priced. Can't go wrong. Go to tryhopsy.com/TCB and use promo code TCB. And for $99, you'll get the Sub home draft machine, two mini kegs of beer, which is the equivalent of 2 6-packs, two Hopsy glasses, and membership in the monthly beer club. That's tryhopsy.com/TCB, promo code TCB, to get a Sub home draft machine, two mini kegs of beer, two Hopsy glasses, and membership in the monthly beer club, all for just $99. It's an amazing deal.
It's a great idea for a beer lover.
It is.
Very easy shopping.
Terms and conditions apply.
So the investigation of the collision got nationwide attention, especially because Diane's husband strongly disagreed with the conclusion that she was heavily intoxicated at the time of the crash. A toxicology report released on August 4th by medical examiners found that Diane had a blood alcohol content of 0.19%, with about 6 grams of alcohol still in her stomach that hadn't been absorbed into her blood yet. Now, the legal BAC limit for driving while intoxicated in New York State is 0.08%. So she was more than double the limit.
Right, and she still had a lot in her stomach, and most of the absorption of alcohol takes place in a small intestine. So another half hour or so, she would have had an even higher blood alcohol concentration.
Interesting. Well, the report also said that she had high levels of THC, which is the active ingredient in marijuana, and she could have smoked marijuana as recently as 15 minutes before the accident.
And Diane had more than twice the legal level of alcohol in her system when the crash occurred. And at that level, she should have had slurred speech, a staggering gait, maybe double vision, lethargy, and difficulty in just sitting up. Yet no one who interacted with her that day saw any of these signs, which leads to the idea that Diane was a chronic heavy drinker. Because we know that a person who drinks heavily can have blood alcohol concentrations that would immobilize or even kill an average person. A heavy drinker's liver has the ability to increase its capacity to metabolize alcohol. Also, the brain becomes more accustomed to frequent high levels of alcohol.
You know, our bodies try really hard to make things work out for us, but sometimes we fight our bodies on that.
We do. Well, and particularly with the liver, it can only do that for so long, and then liver cells start dying and you develop cirrhosis.
Yeah, but that takes years.
Yeah, depending on how much you drink on a daily basis, it can take some time.
What about people who binge drink, like don't drink every day, but then once a week or once every 2 weeks, they have a huge amount? Is that as damaging as the everyday drinking?
Depending, again, on the amount you binge drink.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you could still destroy your liver, even if you only drink once a week, you're saying?
Sure. I mean, if once a week you drink a 30-pack of Bud, maybe that's not the best example, but
I know that works, yeah.
I mean, if you drink heavily, even though it's once a week, you're going to have a problem at some point.
Okay.
And certainly if you're a daily drinker or an almost daily drinker and you drink heavily, it's going to happen sooner. So the testing for THC indicated both long-term and recent use of marijuana.
Yeah, they didn't do the hair testing, which would have showed long-term more, right?
Right.
Because that stays in the hair forever. But in addition, the marijuana really complicates things, right? Because it's not just marijuana and alcohol. They kind of give each other a boost, or
using them together can potentiate the effects of each of them. So that's one thing. One study showed that concomitant use of both can result in paranoia, panic, and anxiety. And then there's another possible side effect that when they're taken together is nausea and vomiting. And we do have at least a couple witnesses who thought they observed Diane being sick to her stomach.
Right, right.
So that could be. And it could be that she just had a bunch of alcohol in her and vomited.
Sure. Yeah, because marijuana is supposed to help with nausea.
Yeah.
But I guess there's only so much it can do.
But not when you do a lot of drinking alcohol with the marijuana.
Well, especially if she was chugging straight vodka.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, shortly after the crash, investigators went to the campground. And they wanted to search the Shuler's trailer camper. It was a pop-up camper. And they were denied entrance to the trailer by the campground owner until a search warrant was obtained. But one interesting thing about this is that the trailer was towed to the Shuler home before police had a chance to search it. So pretty quickly, like within a day or two.
It was gone.
It was gone, so. And we don't know what else was in there.
Nope. The only people that do know are probably Daniel Shuler.
Right.
And maybe his attorney.
Right, exactly.
That's the other thing. He lawyered up pretty quickly.
He did. And I never like to criticize anyone for getting a lawyer. But it's just he was protesting too much, I feel like.
Yeah, well, he gave a press conference on August 8th. And he was there with his attorney, Dominic Barbara. And I think his sister-in-law was there.
Yeah.
Now, Daniel initially denied that Diane did drugs or is drinking that weekend at the lake, since several children were with them. So the first story from Daniel is that my wife is this lovely person who never touches a drop of liquor.
Yeah.
But he changed his story. He denied that his wife ever drank to excess or could have been drunk while driving that day. So yes, she did drink, but not like a lot. Then Larry King and Oprah Winfrey, in two separate shows, obviously, they asked Daniel about the vodka in the van. Daniel claimed that they always kept an old bottle in their camper. Wonderful. And it would last the whole camp season.
That's what he claimed, which a lot of people had a hard time believing that.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing, she's driving her brother's car. So somebody put the vodka in his car.
She did, absolutely, because she's the one that packed up.
If it's the camper's bottle, it got in the car somehow.
Exactly. That's right. Well, on Larry King, I think it was, where Daniel and, is it a sister-in-law, Jay?
Jay's the sister-in-law.
Yeah. Those two were on the Larry King show together. And when they were asked about the vodka, she said, we had it for, sometimes we'd have pina coladas. But, you know, you don't use vodka in a pina colada.
Well, not the way I make them.
Well, I've never heard of it. I mean, I think everyone knows pina colada, rum. Mm-hmm. Regardless, it was just one little thing that made me curious about the whole thing. Like, these people really aren't being honest. Which I kind of, in a way, see. They were trying to defend Diane.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's your first tendency. This is your wife. And she's being vilified, or is going to be vilified. Once the news came out that she was intoxicated, and she caused the deaths of all these people.
Well, blood tests don't lie, do they?
Well, Daniel and his lawyer insisted that there was an error.
Yeah, but there was no sign of an error.
No, and they eventually were repeated, and the test results were the same.
Well, during the investigation, some of Diane's friends and co-workers said that they had seen Diane drinking in months before the crash. A friend of hers named Sheila said that Diane used to meet her at a bar in Long Island, and they would drink screwdrivers while she complained about her marriage. Sheila didn't describe Diane as an alcoholic, but she did say that Diane often had drinks. Now, let's remember, she got an orange juice at the McDonald's, and a screwdriver is vodka and orange juice.
That's correct.
At the heart of the story, I feel, is that Diane was condemned for failing in what is presumed to be a woman's primary thing to do in life, to protect her children. Everyone said she was a good mom, but good moms don't get so drunk and high behind the wheel when they're driving children, especially. I mean, never, I would think, but with the children in the car. That's just crazy. Diane had a problem with alcohol and drugs, and it was a problem that she had been successfully hiding, apparently both at home and at work. And I know it's hard to raise children, and a long car trip with 5 kids under 8 may have seemed intolerable to her. And if she was a closet alcoholic, she probably felt she had to have a drink or two just to deal with it. According to an article I read by author Susan Cheever, who's written several books and articles on addiction, many women, especially women with young kids and important jobs, for them, alcohol and marijuana are what makes it tolerable for them, is how they deal with it. And for a long time, drinking can work well for helping someone to cope. For Diane, like with many addicts, the solution turned out being her problem. So I guess she's an extreme example of what happens to female alcoholics who feel intense pressure to be super moms and to excel at their careers. She did have a lot of pressure.
She certainly did. And you can be an alcoholic and still function on a day-to-day basis, right?
Well, yeah. And I think most of them do for a while.
Quite well.
And then, but I don't think you can go on forever like that, though.
No, you can't. So after Diane's toxicology results became public, there was a lot of useful reporting about women and alcoholism. And for a month or two, a light was shone on the problem. Women alcoholics are different from men and can be harder to identify. For one thing, people can have a hard time believing that a woman can have the same alcohol problems as men.
Yeah, but we do.
Well, yeah. Gender doesn't count.
No, it shouldn't.
The National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism estimates that 1/3 of all alcoholics are women, although many experts consider that estimate too low because of the strategies women often use to conceal their addiction.
Right, so it might be more like 50-50.
It wouldn't surprise me.
I don't see any reason why there'd be more men alcoholics than women, although men might be more outward with it.
Marty Mann, who's the first woman in Alcoholics Anonymous, wrote in a 1970 analysis, "We have a double standard for women. In some areas, behavior that is permissible for men is absolutely unacceptable for women. So this means that when a woman feels uncertain about her drinking, she goes underground."
Yeah, and I think that's even more so for a mom. Mm-hmm. Especially a mom like Diane, who felt like she really needed to be perfect. And then another reason alcoholism in women can go unnoticed is that we tend to spread our addiction among several different substances at once. Because to be slightly addicted to a lot of things is more acceptable in society than to admit that you're enslaved to one thing like alcohol or pot or whatever. So if you look at Diane's case, she struggled with overeating. She smoked pot at night to get a good night's sleep. And she drank, it seems, secretly to cope.
Yeah, now Daniel eventually admitted that he and his wife had been drinking during the camping trip. So this is the third story. First was she doesn't drink. Second was she sometimes drinks, but she didn't drink that weekend. Now it's, yes, she was drinking during the camping trip that weekend.
Right, but not the night before or the day of the crash is what he said this time.
It's his story.
Yep.
And then the campground co-owner, who knew the Shuleys pretty well, saw them off at around 9 o'clock in the morning. And she said that Diane appeared sober. The gas station employee who Diane asked for Tylenol gel caps at around 11 in the morning also said, "I knew for a fact that she wasn't drunk when she came into the station."
Now you can't know that.
No.
Especially if she's experienced at hiding it.
And does this guy have a breathalyzer in his nose or something?
No, okay, of course not.
And then according to Tom Ruskin, who was an investigator hired by Daniel, none of the McDonald's employees saw anything in her behavior to suggest that she was intoxicated. In fact, she was seen carrying on an involved conversation while ordering her food and her orange juice.
Yeah, and that might be where she started drinking, so she might not really have been drunk yet.
No.
No?
She could have started.
Right.
But I think she had been drinking the night before.
Okay.
So I think she already had some elevation in her blood alcohol level, and this was kind of like the hair of the dog.
Well, if that's the case, she was probably a very heavy drinker.
Well, I'm just surmising things.
Is it based on any factual information?
Well, I'm looking at the timing here.
Yes.
I'm looking at the timeline, and I'm thinking if she didn't start drinking till after the McDonald's visit, there wasn't that much time to get all that vodka into her.
Well, I mean, you're talking a couple hours, and they're saying she chugged a lot of alcohol in a short time, so I wouldn't be surprised, really. I mean, 11 o'clock, she's looking for the gel caps. She could have already been drinking then. The crash happened around 1:30.
Mm-hmm.
So it's possible that she started drinking a little later in the morning.
Yeah.
She did look very sober to people when she left at 9:30 at the camp.
Sure. But like we've said, if you're a chronic heavy drinker, you can tolerate elevated blood alcohol levels and not appear impaired.
Right. And I think vodka is one of the ones that doesn't have as much of an odor as like whiskey. Just saying from things I've heard, I don't have any personal experience with that. Ruskin told reporters that September that he had interviewed relatives, none of whom had ever seen Diane drunk. Ruskin also pointed out autopsy results that showed no organ damage, often found in alcoholics. Although an uninvolved medical examiner said that these results don't rule out alcoholism.
No, we've said that.
Yeah, you touched on that.
Now, maybe if they had done a liver biopsy 10 years later, they would have found signs of cirrhosis.
If she'd continued drinking into her 40s.
Right.
Yeah. She's only 36.
Yeah, so I'm in agreement with the other medical examiner.
Okay.
That a normal liver doesn't rule out alcohol as a problem.
So that doesn't really mean anything.
No, I don't think so.
Daniel denied that his wife did drugs, but he did tell investigators that she smoked marijuana occasionally. And the family told People magazine that she used it to help her sleep. Although Daniel was an officer in the public security unit of the Nassau County Police Department, he wasn't required to report his wife's drug use like he would have been if he was a policeman, because he was still considered a civilian in his job as a security officer. So in November, it was reported that Diane's sister-in-law made a statement to police that Diane actually smoked marijuana on a regular basis. And she does say that also in the documentary. There's something wrong with Aunt Diane. So their stories change. The people who are trying to deny Diane had any kind of problem, their stories really do change over the course of time.
Yeah, well, the stories have to change because they can't maintain what they first said in the face of the evidence against it.
Sure.
So they can't say she didn't drink or she never smoked marijuana. Because the testing that was done twice showed those results.
Sure.
So, got to change the story. But we're still trying to sugarcoat it a little bit.
A little bit. But I mean, saying that she took it to sleep at night is kind of saying she was a regular user of marijuana, which is very different from what they said in the beginning.
Right. So first, she doesn't do marijuana. Then she smoked it occasionally. And then another relative says, well, yeah, she used it to sleep.
This is super blatant denial, especially when they start bringing up the medical issues.
Yeah, this was a tough one to listen to. So Daniel Schuler and his attorney believe that Diane drove erratically due to a medical issue, like a stroke. According to them, Diane was obese for much of her life. She was 5'2 and weighed about 210.
Yep.
And suffered from diabetes. It wasn't type 2 diabetes or type 1 diabetes. She had gestational diabetes, which is a temporary condition related to pregnancy. Although people with gestational diabetes have a higher incidence of type 2 diabetes later in life. But anyway, there wasn't any evidence that she had diabetes.
No, so she didn't have extremely low or high blood sugar. Anything that would have made her behave oddly, which can happen to diabetics. They can behave very strangely if their sugars are off.
Schuler and his attorney also talked about an abscess that had persisted in her mouth for 7 weeks before her death, an abscess tooth, and a lump in her leg, about which they said might have been an embolism. The lump was a superficial lump, according to the reports, that was movable. So it's hard to believe that something like that is going to cause an embolus.
Well, and I mean, just look at the autopsy results.
Right. Did they find any of those?
Well, the results of the autopsy, one day after the accident, found that Diane had not suffered a stroke, didn't have an aneurysm, didn't have a heart attack, and there actually wasn't even any evidence of a tooth abscess in her autopsy.
Right. In September, New York's top forensic pathologist said that a hair test should have been done to determine Diane's drug history. Daniel Shuler and his lawyer announced plans to exhume the body to perform the hair test and other examinations. But experts said that was unlikely to produce any new information of value, since tests from two separate labs came up with exactly the same conclusion.
Yeah, but his denial is so deep. He also wanted to retest the fluid samples taken during the autopsy. The Westchester County Medical Examiner's Office, who performed the autopsy, said that the degradation of the fluids over time was likely to result in lowered alcohol and THC readings. However, several toxicology experts said that the results should be similar to the previous test if the fluid samples had been properly stored, which they were. They were similar.
Right, and doing further testing on these samples isn't going to gain any new information.
It's not going to change. I mean, with the documentary, they went to all these lengths. They even got Werner Spitz, that famous pathologist, and he said there was nothing wrong with the autopsy or the results, that they were correct.
Yet on November 7th, Ruskin, the private investigator, announced that the Shuler family had raised the money to retest Diane's tissue samples, and that the retesting would soon take place. Never did.
Well, it did. There was a whole thing between the private investigator and Daniel Shuler, with Daniel saying he didn't do it, and the investigator saying they did do it, and we did find out the retesting did take place, and everything was correct. It checked out.
Yeah, and the investigator hadn't talked to Daniel about that.
Well, we don't know if Daniel was maybe hiding that information. Daniel said the investigator didn't give him the information, but the investigator said he did. So that's a whole separate issue that we don't know.
It is, and it didn't...
Doesn't really matter.
...offer any new information.
No.
Then in July of 2010, so almost a year after the crash, it was reported that Daniel Shuler had accepted a $100,000 offer from a film company, Moxie Firecracker Films, to record his wife's exhumation for an HBO documentary. How macabre. Jeez. Now, reportedly, the money was going to be placed in a trust for son Brian.
Yeah, because Brian did have some lingering issues from his brain trauma.
Oh, he does.
So Daniel's persistence in disputing his wife's intoxication and denying her drug use has really been heavily condemned by relatives of the three men in the Trailblazer who were killed. When Daniel was on CNN's Larry King Live to demand more testing of his wife's remains, Longo's brother, Joseph, issued a statement saying in part, "I want Daniel Shuler to know that he keeps inflicting more pain on all concerned once again by going to the media to try to paint a picture of this perfect wife and mother." So they want him to let it go.
And Michael Bastardi's daughters appeared with their lawyer on NBC's Today Show, and they questioned Daniel's culpability in enabling Diane's substance abuse and called for him to undergo drug testing himself. "Makes me angry that he keeps denying it," said Margaret Nicotina, Bastardi's daughter. "Every time he does it, he brings it back for us. I wish he would just admit that she was drunk. Maybe if he knows what happened that morning, if they argued or anything, that would be the truth. He wants the truth, so do we." And their lawyer called Daniel Shuler's position totally outrageous, an insult to the intelligence of the American public, and a hoax. Ruskin said on the Oprah Winfrey Show in October 2009 that Daniel Shuler had avoided media appearances since Larry King Live out of respect for the Bastardi family.
Well, do we want to go there and talk about respect? Because I don't think there was ever a public apology or a private one that we know of.
Not that we know of.
I would think... You know that she was drunk and on drugs, and whatever the issue, why wouldn't you apologize to the victims?
He's too invested in his life.
Whoa. All right. Well, in June 2010, the New York State Police issued the final report on the accident following 11 months of analysis. And the report upheld the previous toxicology findings that she was intoxicated and had high levels of THC in her system as well as alcohol. So it wasn't really an accident at all. It was a homicide.
Yes, it was. And was it a homicide-suicide?
Sure. Well, yes.
You think so?
Well, there was no way she was going to kill all those people and she was going to get out of it alive.
Right. So you're your take is that she intentionally drove the wrong way on the Taconic.
Oh, sure.
And was going to kill herself, and it didn't matter who else she killed with her.
To me, that's the only way to look at it. What do you think?
Yeah, I was just playing kind of devil's advocate for you.
Okay.
I know you brought this up, and we both think that it was a suicide, homicide.
Which doesn't mean I have no empathy for the woman. The woman had issues. But once you decide to kill other people, it's hard to have any sympathy for that.
For sure.
But maybe to really understand what happened on the parkway that Sunday, we need to look back to when Diane was this 9-year-old girl and her mother left. Maybe she never recovered from this trauma. She did refuse to seek professional help or discuss the issue at all with family and close friends. In fact, the friends of Diane who were interviewed in that documentary, There's Something Wrong with Aunt Diane, didn't seem to know what was going on with her on any kind of a deeper level. She seemed to be someone who was keeping her feelings bottled up and was really striving to present herself in a positive light at all times.
Over her lifetime, Diane's mother attempted several times to reconcile with Diane, who was her only daughter. While she eventually reconciled with her sons, Diane's mother was continually rebuffed by Diane. And she may have had legitimate reasons for not allowing her mother back into her life.
Well, that's true, because we don't know what her mother was like. Maybe her mother was a bad person.
We don't. But the abandonment and her refusal to talk about it could be an issue that could have led to depression and substance abuse.
Yeah, Diane's friends described her as someone who kept her feelings to herself. They said they'd never seen her angry, and she didn't share anything about her feelings or how her marriage was going, even with her closest women friends. She could also be very controlling. It seems like anything outside of this image as the perfect mother was not something she was willing to discuss. The topic of her parents' divorce and her mother's estrangement from the family was almost seen as forbidden, and some of Diane's friends had actually assumed that her mother was dead. Then there's this marriage of Diane and Daniel. She worked her day job as an executive, and Daniel worked nights, getting home after midnight. When he got home, Diane would already be asleep in bed. She could have easily been drinking alone at night after putting the kids to bed before he got home. She could have been passing out every night. Now, they did spend these weekends together doing family activities, but how much intimacy Daniel and Diane shared is really unknown.
Yeah, well, look at the weekend that they were at the camp, the last weekend.
Yeah.
He went up a day or two before, saying he wanted to do some fishing, and she drove the kids up the next day.
Yeah, and then they came back home separately as well.
Yeah, so they took two vehicles up and two back. So that's interesting to me. It would seem if I don't see my wife much on the weekdays because of our jobs, I'd want to spend more time with her on the weekends.
Well, Dickie, not everyone has a wife like you, though.
Well, I know that. Hardly anybody does.
Yeah, I'm kidding, of course. But in one interview, Daniel really dismissed the notion that he didn't have a relationship with his wife beyond a superficial level. He said that she would talk to him when things came up. But then he actually added, you know, things like the house needs painting and the gutters need to be cleaned. And he didn't even seem to realize that that comment was really proving the point that he was trying to deny.
That's right. So people who knew Diane said that she did not complain. She showed interest in their lives, bought them gifts, and her life was kept under wraps in many ways. So some people have theorized that the trauma Diane had experienced when her mother left the family may have left Diane needing the perfect family. So to keep the image of a perfect family going meant not bringing up problems in the marriage or complaining to Daniel. She would feel that she had to show a perfect face to the world. Conflicting work schedules certainly allowed Diane to keep an emotional distance from her husband.
And sometimes it's easier to tell your problems to people you aren't close to, so that might explain this Sheila person that she was going out and having drinks with. Well, and she'd talk to her about the marriage.
Sure.
But the people who were actually close to her, she didn't say anything to. To me, that makes sense.
Perfect sense.
So after they had kids, maintaining this perfect image could have become more difficult. And working in the high-level job she had and raising the kids, kind of on her own, every evening at least, was probably very stressful. And she may have also been becoming disillusioned by her fantasies of this perfect family, not being the reality.
Now, Daniel had admitted that Diane had some impulse control issues, which he saw sometimes in her impulsive shopping. He recalled an incident where she went out to buy groceries and returned home with a new Jeep Grand Cherokee. Another time she went out for milk and came home with a flat-screen TV. Did she maybe do other impulsive things when she escaped the responsibilities of work and home? Like drink to excess, smoke a little marijuana? Shopping may have just been one way that she treated her anxiety. Daniel also described how Diane would begin her Christmas shopping in July, and they had their attic stuffed with clothes and toys for the children for years in advance, so she was covering all the bases.
Yeah, so if you look back, her life had this event that was totally out of her control when her parents divorced and her mom left. And according to the forensic psychiatrist in the documentary, this life event could have made her hyper-responsible, so that she only felt okay when she was totally in control. And then I've read some things about OCPD, which is Obsessive Compulsive Personality Disorder.
Yeah, this was an interesting article.
Yeah.
And it was written not as a diagnosis of Diane, but as a possible explanation.
Yeah, kind of a theory.
Yeah.
Which we looked into, and I kind of saw some validity in that theory. Because if this is an untreated condition, she was obsessed with perfection, overly rigid, stubborn, and focused on having everything in perfect order. So people with OCPD have a high level of anxiety. And Daniel, on the other hand, seemed like such a passive personality who just allowed Diane to manage everything. So she really had everything on her plate. So maybe something happened that morning before Diane left the camp. She may have had an argument with her husband. The kids may have been driving her crazy. She may have seemed fine, but she may have been boiling with anger that she was left in control of these kids as Daniel took the truck and the dog. I can see that.
Well, you got 5 kids under the age of 8 or 9, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's got the dog in the truck. So maybe she took that bottle of vodka secretly to just try and drink off some of the stress, thinking I'll have a drink or two. And then things escalated. I think she probably began drinking at the McDonald's around 10 when she got the orange juice. But then I also wonder about wanting the gel caps instead of regular Tylenol. I almost wonder if she was planning on putting some THC or some other drug into the capsules. If she had a terrible headache or a toothache, any Tylenol, you'd just buy it, right? You'd be desperate.
Yeah, and it'll work.
Well, also, like you said, she would have been home in an hour or so and could have taken the medication in the peace of her own home. So why wouldn't you just try and get home and then take care of it, get the kids out of the van, you know, have a little peace and take your Tylenol? Why would you want those capsules? It's a little weird.
Yeah, I think it is. The only thing I would add to this is that I think she had been drinking the night before and was still a little bit under the weather in the morning, even though she appeared to be fine.
And that could give you a headache too.
Yeah.
Sure.
Regardless, I mean, we know what her blood alcohol level was. We know that there's a certain amount still in her stomach, so we know what she'd been doing.
Yeah, we can theorize about what she did the day before or whatever, but it really doesn't matter in the big scheme of things.
No. Now, if Diane did have a personality disorder, she would be at increased risk for homicide and suicide. She would also have difficulty with empathy and prioritizing the children's lives above her own problems. The crash doesn't seem like an accident. Witnesses said that she's making a beeline down the highway, not swerving aimlessly. Either she is too high to care if she took the children with her, or she planned on taking them all out with her. The drinking and smoking may have been her way of building up her courage to follow through with her homicide-suicide plan.
Well, there were definite signs that this was a calculated action. It appears that she carefully placed her phone on the concrete barrier, leaving it so she couldn't be tracked, or she couldn't be swayed to change her plan by a ringing phone. And the barrier where she left her phone was actually right across from a police station, so if she wanted to get help, she could have done that too. But instead she took off, driving aggressively, honking and tailgating, as if she was angry and she wanted a violent end to her life. And if this is the case, she must have really had some deep down rage and aggression, which I believe that kind of stuff comes out when you have too much to drink. Your deep down emotions are going to come to the surface, and it's harder to keep those things under wraps. And she definitely seemed willing to take out unknown motorists and even the children in the car who, you would have to say she loved these kids. There's no evidence that she didn't.
No, and she drove against traffic for nearly 2 miles in the passing lane.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And she never veered. Witnesses who saw her in the car near the end described her expression as determined and serene. And when witnesses reached the van on foot, the front of the van was engulfed in flames.
Well, I really hate to imagine that terrifying ride for Emma and the other children. They must have been screaming and panic-stricken. Can you imagine being in a car with someone doing that and you have no control over it?
I can't. I really can't. These are little kids. At least the older ones must have been scared out of their minds.
And this was a woman that they had trusted. Right. Their aunt or their mother.
Yeah.
Crazy.
The little girl, the 8-year-old daughter who called her father and said there's something wrong with Aunt Diane, must have known what was going on.
Oh, sure. You don't have to be very old to realize that you're in danger of dying a horrible death.
No. So as you can imagine, this crash spawned a few lawsuits. Late in 2009, Roseanne Guzzo, who is Michael Bastardi's daughter, filed a wrongful death suit against the Schuler estate and Warren Hance, because Warren Hance was the owner of the car. She claimed that Diane had operated the vehicle while intoxicated, causing the deaths of her father and brother. Then in 2011, with the statute of limitation for wrongful death soon to expire, other suits were filed. Daniel Schuler alleged that the state of New York was accountable due to poor roadway design and improper signage.
I don't see any validity in that. There were signs there, and it's not as if she got on there and realized she made a mistake and tried to avoid people.
Right.
So I don't buy that at all.
Schuler also filed suit against his brother-in-law, Warren Hance, saying that as owner of the minivan, he was responsible for the accident.
Now that is just disgusting and makes no sense to me. Is that something because of insurance he did that, or?
I have no idea.
How dare he?
Now, the blogs I read about the lawsuits, impression was that neither of his suits were ever going to go to court. They were going to be dismissed.
I can't believe he even did that. His wife killed all of Warren's children.
Yep. Then Jackie Hance, who's the mother of the 3 girls killed, sued Schuler's estate. And one other suit was brought by Joseph Longo, who was the brother of one of the occupants of the other car. He sued both the Schuler estate and Warren Hance. All of these suits have either been settled or dismissed. However, the terms of settlement are confidential, and court records are sealed, so we'll never know anything else.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to know, though, wouldn't it?
It would.
But I just feel sick to my stomach thinking that Daniel Schuler sued his brother-in-law, the father of the 3 girls that were killed.
He didn't come across as a very likable guy anyway.
Well, no, but that's just...
And that's just a shitty thing to do.
It sure is.
But lawyers must have been advising him.
I don't care. I don't see anything okay with that.
No.
So if you want more information on this, New York Magazine had an article called I Dream of Diane. What do you do with the grief and guilt when your wife drives the wrong way on the Taconic State Parkway with a van full of kids and a body full of alcohol and ends up in a crash that kills 8? You put her in a shrine. It was an interesting article. Also, of course, there's the documentary, There's Something Wrong with Aunt Diane, which is an HBO documentary. There are also a couple of books. There's The Taconic Tragedy, A Son's Search for Truth, and that's by Jean Bastardi.
Yes, she's Michael Bastardi Jr.'s wife.
Well, okay, so it was her father-in-law was killed.
And her brother-in-law.
And Jackie Hance, the mother of Diane's 3 nieces who were killed in the crash, also wrote a book called I'll See You Again about dealing with the loss of her children. So different kind of book.
Yes.
So let's just take a moment here to tell our listeners about a new podcast that we've been listening to.
The assassination of President John F. Kennedy by Lee Harvey Oswald changed the course of history. But would things have turned out differently if Oswald wasn't successful in killing the president? Now that's a good question. What, for example, would have happened with Russia? We certainly had our difficulties with them. Would President Kennedy have served a second term? He was the first Roman Catholic president. And he was certainly a polarizing figure at that time. The new podcast, Assassinations, from the Parcast Network, examines what happens when murder meets public figures.
Assassinations takes a deep dive into the life of some of the world's most infamous assassins to discover what motivated them to take such drastic measures. Hosts Bill and Kate examine these assassinations through the lens of both the target and the assassin, asking, did the assassin ultimately achieve his, her underlying objective? And if so, how did it change the world? New episodes come out every week. Check out the 3-part episode on John F. Kennedy right now. Look for upcoming episodes on Malcolm X and pop singer Selena, too. New episodes come out every Monday.
So search and subscribe to Assassinations wherever you listen to podcasts. Again, that's Assassinations. Or visit parcast.com/assassinations to start listening now. That's Parcast, parcast.com/assassinations to listen now.
Fascinating stuff.
Really is. I like this history stuff.
The music for True Crime Brewery was written and produced by Tristan Capel. If you want more TCB, you can go to our website, tiegrabber.com, and join Team Tiegrabber for access to members-only episodes. Along with this exclusive access to our large bank of members-only episodes, you'll get a gift from us, as well as our undying admiration. You can also go to Patreon and become a patron of True Crime Brewery and get the same benefits. In November, we covered the murders at White House Farm, and other members-only episodes include the case of mom and child killer Diane Downs, our O.J. Simpson series, the killings of the Kissel brothers, and the kidnapping of Shannon Matthews, plus a lot more. For our special Christmas edition on the Members Only feed, we will be watching and podcasting about one of our favorite Christmas love stories, The Family Man, starring the lovely Tia Leone and the irrepressible Nick Cage. So this could be some good audio candy for your holiday blues. Other ways to show your support for True Crime Brewery are following us on Twitter at Tiegrabber Pods, on Instagram, Tiegrabber Podcasts, as well as on Facebook. If you enjoy the show, please take a minute to give us a review on iTunes or wherever you listen. We would really appreciate that. So let's go ahead and move forward with feedback. And remember, you can send feedback and case suggestions to us in an email to truecrimebrewery@tiegrabber.com. Or you can tell us in your own voice by leaving a voicemail on the Leave a Voicemail link on the front page of our website. If you submit a voicemail by the end of the year, and if we play it on an episode, we're going to send you an absolutely free TCB t-shirt. Well, one last note, if you shop the brewery at tiegrabber.com, you'll see that we now have a link to our TeePublic store where you can get TCB logos on everything from hoodies to cell phone cases.
Lots and lots.
Yes. So that's the end of my spiel.
Back. Some different designs too.
Yeah, some good stuff.
I'm pretty impressed.
We'll probably end up buying some ourselves.
I'm sure we will. So we've got 3 voicemails and a couple emails. So as the usual, we'll start with the voicemails. Dawn has a case suggestion.
Let's listen to what Dawn had to say.
Hello, Jill and Dick. I hope things are well with you at the quiet end. I am actually returning to the quiet end today because I left a voicemail last week and realized I may have left out some pertinent information. My name is Dawn, and I suggested a case regarding Mark Brooks, who in 1989 had killed someone on the side of the road just for kicks. He was someone I went to high school with, and he was somewhat of an outsider, and he did not act alone. He was with another boy, and as I remember it, they actually killed him near what used to be called the Jesus Tree, which was like this place in Danbury, Connecticut, where people would go to do weird stuff and act like it was a big mysterious spot. There were also all these trees around it they called the 12 Apostles. But since this tree has been taken down, apparently Mark and his friend decided to kill someone just for the fun of feeling what it was like to murder someone. And they flagged a motorist who was about their age, and the boy got out to help them since they were under disguise of having a broken down car, and they shot him and stole $4 out of his pocket. And then they went to the mall and bragged about it, because that's usually what you do when these things happen. So they went to jail. And as it turns out, years later, Mark decided he wanted a sex change and was suing, I think, the prison system to get his sex change. Now, why he wanted that, I don't know. My only guess is that he absolutely could not stand being in a men's prison, but I cannot speculate on that. So this murder happened in Connecticut. I live in New York now, but as far as Connecticut breweries go, well, I'm not sure. I'm a bourbon drinker, and I'm not very useful with that because I usually like light blonde sort of ales or Hefeweizens. So I think I'm probably pretty bad at suggesting a beer because I hate mostly everything except for just a few small things. I will tolerate most others. I'm not a hoppy person. I'm happy, but I'm not hoppy. So I'm not in with the cool kids on the hoppiness. I also don't like sours. So sorry, Jill. I think you like sours. Ugh, I just can't. So I'll just have my bourbon at the quiet end and let you guys enjoy the beer. So thank you very much. I absolutely love, love, love your show and look forward to Tuesdays where I can sit at work and ask for people not to bother me while I listen to my murders. All right. Have a great Thanksgiving. Bye.
Thanks, Don. I hope you had a good Thanksgiving.
I thought you'd like that one.
Yeah, it was a good one.
Well, I thought it was an interesting case because we've got this guy who decides to kill somebody just for the sake of seeing what it felt like.
Yeah, that's terrible.
And then he's in prison and he decides that he's really female and he wants to have a sex change operation paid for by the state of Connecticut.
I can't judge that because I don't know, but the murder is horrible.
It is. So I'm going to look into that, Dawn, and we'll see where we go.
Okay, what about Connecticut beers? Are you up on any of that?
Well, I've had a few. Nothing that much comes to mind. I drink a lot of Thomas Hooker beers.
Uh-huh.
Good breweries in Connecticut.
Okay.
So I'm sure we can find a beer.
Okay, sounds good.
All right, so that's Dawn. Then we have Brittany, who also has a case suggestion.
Hi, Jill and Dick. My name is Brittany. I'm from Calgary, Alberta, Canada. I love your podcast, and I've been wanting to send in a voicemail for a while now because I have lots of beer suggestions for Dick,
woo-hoo.
But I've been too chicken until now. I thought I would send in a suggestion for a Canadian case because I've been listening for about a year now, and I've noticed you guys haven't done a lot of Canadian cases, and there are some really interesting ones. Plus, we have great beer here. My suggestion is for the case of Mark Twitchell. He was convicted of first-degree murder in 2011 for killing John Brian Johnny Altinger. His trial attracted a lot of media attention here because he was actually inspired by the TV series Dexter, the one about the serial killer who works as a forensic bloodstain pattern analyst. Mark, he dismembered Altinger and then dumped his remains in an Edmonton sewer. Really interesting and really disturbing case. I would love to hear your opinions on it. And as an added bonus, there's lots of information on the case, including a Dateline episode. As for a beer suggestion, my new favorite right now, it's brewed here in Calgary. It's from the Annex Ale Project, Force Major Double Dry Hopped New England IPA. And I know you've been staying away from IPAs, Dick, but you have to try it. I promise it will be delicious. Thanks, guys, for all you do and for the hours of entertainment and great listening that you provide. I'll definitely continue to be a regular at the quiet end. Bye.
Thanks so much, Brittany.
Good sound and beer suggestion. I don't think I've ever had a beer from Calgary.
Wow. That's pretty amazing. She found a beer you haven't tried.
You give me too much credit.
Okay. So yeah. What do we know about the case she suggested?
Well, just as Brittany told it, it's a Dexter wannabe. He was an aspiring filmmaker and had this grand dream of making blockbuster movies. Before the killing, he did shoot a short horror film at a garage that he rented in the south end of Edmonton.
I think I've heard of this case.
Well, I mean, just the association with Dexter would give it some notoriety.
Yeah, I probably saw the Dateline a while back.
We'll check into it.
Yeah, let's do that.
And thank you, Brittany, for the beer suggestions.
Yes, and for being a loyal listener at the quiet end, of course.
Okay, one more voicemail.
Okay, and who's this from?
This is Kate.
We need to start using the last initials or something because we have a lot of Kates.
Hi, Jill and Dick. This is Kate, longtime listener, first-time caller. I wanted to start out by saying how much I love your well-researched podcast. The balance of the medical and scientific insight you provide, along with the humanistic approach, truly makes this podcast one of a kind. Secondly, with the listener feedback section you devote to your episodes day in and day out, or rather, week in and week out, it helps to build a community throughout this podcast and the podcasting community. Finally, I wanted to say how much I truly appreciate your candid conversations and how much respect you show for one another, even when you differ in those opinions. It's truly an example that I try to emulate in my relationship with my significant other, and in many ways, I consider you to a role model for a respectful and kind relationship. So thank you for providing that as well for me, and I'm sure I'm not the only one. Next, I would like to talk about the dog mauling case, and you had said, I think it was Jill, asked why an adult would want to be adopted. I would say that the first reason that may be a situation that happens is because when they're the next of kin, they're then considered a heir to the estate. Therefore, they would get the inheritance when the adoptee, when the adopter rather, passes away. The adoptee would then inherit any assets of the adopters. Also, there are different visiting rights in a prison, which is what the situation was in this gentleman, that he was in prison. Family has different visiting rights than the general public or even attorneys. So that could be another reason why they wanted to do the adoption. Finally, I have a case suggestion. It's the case of Eric Dean out of Minnesota. There's a very good article, actually a series of articles, in the Star Tribune, which is the Twin Cities paper, called Eric Dean, the Boy They Couldn't Save. I know you have a lot of trouble doing child abuse cases, but this is truly a case that I think you should cover. This situation brought to light the cracks children can fall through in child protection, but it actually provided a visual to what was happening and created a child welfare reform in the state of Minnesota, including better funding and for the child welfare system. Thank you again and have a wonderful day. Thank you.
Thanks, Kate. Thank you for all the nice things you said, first of all. And thank you for your case suggestion. So what do we know about this case, Dick?
Well, the stepmother or girlfriend of the father, I don't know if they had married or not, but she caused the death of 4-year-old Eric Dean. She was convicted of first-degree murder while committing child abuse with a past pattern of child abuse, second-degree murder without intent while committing a felony, and second-degree manslaughter.
And this was a 4-year-old boy.
It's a little 4-year-old.
Heartbreaking.
It is. Now, the other thing Kate had mentioned, that this did result in some good in terms of fixing the broken child protective services in Minnesota. Apparently, there were at least 15 reports to CPS by school teachers or daycare people,
neighbors
and so on. And nothing happened.
So was the father in on this? We don't know.
Don't know.
Because it just seems hard to believe that one parent wouldn't know the other parent was doing this. Possible, yeah. But hard to believe.
Hard to believe. But it's a horrible story that you figure, okay, here's a kid who's getting abused. If you report it to Child Protective Services, that should take care of things.
So people were doing the right thing by making the reports.
People were making the reports, but CPS was overworked, overburdened, overlooked stuff, whatever. That, I think, would be an interesting case.
So this wasn't that long ago. It was 2013.
Right.
And she allegedly became upset with him and threw him across the room. Then he got ill later that night into the next day before they called the ambulance. And he died in the hospital. Must have been a head injury.
No, he had peritonitis. He was had blunt trauma to the abdomen,
wow,
which opened up a bowel. So he had pretty severe injuries.
So she didn't just toss him across the room. She really injured this kid.
Yeah, and there's so many instances of abuse by her on this kid that it's tough to decide which was the one that did it.
Well, and it's hard for me to believe that this kid wasn't crying and screaming in pain.
He might have been. She was watching
him. She was ignoring him. Yeah. Heartbreaking, but definitely a case worth looking into. Because I like the fact that it did make some positive changes.
Yeah, that's the only good thing that came out of this.
Yeah. Okay. So that's it for the voicemails?
That's it for the voicemails. I got a backlog of them.
I know you do, and that's great.
You let me do some more, we can...
I can only handle three if we want to keep doing emails.
All right.
But anybody who does have it read, our three voicemails today, please send me your address and your preferred shirt size because I want to send you a t-shirt because I love voicemails. Okay, so we have an email from Cindy. And Cindy wrote, I just finished listening to your case cold as ice. I feel so bad for that family in that Rachel's parents lost a daughter and a granddaughter. So that was Rachel and Lillian Entwistle. The case really tugged at my heart for the obvious reasons as it would tug at others' hearts. I'm really anxious, and I have mentioned this before, for you to cover the case of the murder of Jim and Naomi Olive by their adopted teenage daughter Marlene and her boyfriend Chuck Riley. I'm really interested in teens who kill, and this case definitely shows the clash between parents and teenagers, especially parents who are old enough to be grandparents and are practically senior citizens. It is a story about Marlene trying to learn to be an American teenager, and her parents don't understand her and the drug culture. I look on the cases each week to see if you have covered this one, and I'm anxious to hear your perspective on it. I would also like you to do a program on the Mary Winkler case, about the wife who killed her pastor husband. This case shows that pastors aren't what we feel they should be in private. This man was extremely abusive to her and tried to harm the kids as well. I'm just as anxious for you to do this one as I am for you to do the Naomi Jim Olive case. Thanks for your perspective and all that you do. I love listening to each and every podcast. I would like to hear your perspective on bullying as well, just like in the Bad Girls podcast. That one just broke my heart after reading the book Cruel Sacrifice. I think there she means Mean Girls, which was Shonda Scherer.
Right.
Which also the one we just did, which might have been after she wrote this email, was on teenage girls.
Yeah, I think this email was before the niece case.
Okay.
The barbecue murders are referred to the 1975 double homicide in Marin County, California. Jim Olive and his wife, Naomi, were murdered in their home by their 16-year-old adopted daughter, Marlene, and her 20-year-old boyfriend, Charles Riley, called Chuck. They then attempted to dispose of the bodies by burning them in a barbecue pit at a nearby campground, hence the barbecue murders.
Ugh.
So Riley was convicted of two counts of first-degree murder and received a sentence of death, which was later changed to life imprisonment with the possibility of parole. Marlene got to be tried as a juvenile and received a sentence of 3 to 6 years in a California Youth Authority juvenile facility, and she was released at age 21, having served a little over 4 years. So this case gained a lot of attention due to the age of the perpetrators, 16 and 20, the details of the crime, and the wide disparity in sentencing between the two perps. And they continue to be subjects of interest because of his repeated bids for parole. And Marlene, apparently, since she's been released at age 21, has had several run-ins with the law.
Oh, wow.
So, sounded interesting.
Okay. And then the other case she mentioned was Mary Carol Winkler, who's an American woman who was convicted of voluntary manslaughter in the 2006 shooting of her husband, Matthew Winkler. And he was a pulpit minister at the 4th Street Church of Christ in Selmer, Tennessee. Winkler gained national attention because of public speculation regarding her motives and her mental health, allegations of abuse by her husband, her brief flight from the state, and for the brief length of her jail sentence. In August 2008, Winkler was granted full custody of her three daughters. Now that I read this, I remember the Winkler case pretty well.
Yeah, we've heard of it.
Yeah. So those are good suggestions.
And yeah.
Cindy's someone who writes to us quite a bit and puts a lot of thought into it. So thanks a lot, Cindy. I do appreciate that.
Okay, then we got Stacy.
Another email.
Another email. Stacy says, first and foremost, I love your podcast. I wanted to suggest the case of Shannon Christian and Christopher Newsom for you guys to cover. This case is one of the most heinous crimes that I've come across in a long time, and I am a frequenter of true crime. It also sadly did not get the coverage that I think it was due. Two attractive young adults were carjacked, tortured, and brutalized in the worst way by a group of individuals. I just wanted to share this case with you. If you had not already heard of it, keep doing what you do. Thanks.
I haven't heard of it. Have you? Well, I know you've looked at it since you read the email, but yeah, did you know about it before?
No, I hadn't heard of it before.
Okay, so what did you find out about it?
Well, Shannon and Hugh Christopher were 21 and 23 from Knoxville. They were kidnapped on the evening of January 6, 2007, when Christian's vehicle was carjacked. They were taken to a rental house where both of them were raped, tortured, and finally murdered. Four males and one female were arrested, charged, and convicted in the case. The grand jury had indicted four of the suspects on counts of capital murder, robbery, kidnapping, rape, and theft, while the fifth was indicted on federal charges of carjacking, but was also indicted for theft, murder, and rape years after the fact in 2018. So the four charged at the state level, three of them had multiple prior felony convictions. After a jury trial, one was convicted and sentenced to death by lethal injection. The other two were convicted and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. And the woman was convicted and sentenced to 53 years in prison, which was later reduced to 35. Then the fifth guy was convicted and sentenced to 18 years in federal prison for being an accessory. But as mentioned, in 2018, he was also indicted for the kidnappings, murders, and rape. So he's facing more time, probably.
This seems like a terrible, terrible crime and done by a group of people. It's pretty shocking.
It is. I need to look at that more.
Yeah.
All these state convictions were initially set aside because of potential misconduct by the presiding judge, who has since been disbarred. So retrials were originally slated for the summer and fall of 2012. Now, the orders for retrials of two of them was overturned by the Tennessee State Supreme Court, and their conviction and sentences stand. The other retrials resulted in convictions, but with a reduced sentence for the two.
All right.
Sounded like an interesting one to look up.
It does. Our listeners send us good stuff. They don't just send us shit, you know. They know what they're doing. Okay, well, I think that wraps it up for the day, Dickie. I have to go grocery shopping, so leave you here at the quiet end and come back after, or you want to come with me?
No, I'll wait here for you.
Okay. Well, we'll see you next time, everyone, at the quiet end.
Come join us. Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye. Thank you.